Welcome to Tell Me Your Story. I cannot tell you how grateful I am to have you on board, folks, to talk about what we're going to talk about today. It's, to me, going to be a lot of fun talking with our very special guest, and I never did ask him which he preferred. You folks know me as Richard Dugan. I also go by Reverend Dr. D. But our guest I have listed as Rich Carr, and that's C-A-R-R, not C-A-R. And we're going to be talking about some very incredible things from his website and the work that he's been doing over, goodness, we'll find out how many years, at brain-centric.com. We'll be linked to that website. Rich, which do you prefer, if it even matters? And welcome to Tell Me Your Story.
Rich is probably the one I've been preferring since about third grade.
Okay. All I know is that, as most of us may as kids, when you heard, or when I heard, Richard Les Dugan, you knew you were in trouble.
Yeah, so, Richard Lyle Carr was my echo of that. And for whatever reason, I remember getting, I was in the principal's office in third grade, and it was Richard, 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 and it sounded like my mom or dad yelling at me, like you said. And I remember after I went into the class after that, it was like, Richard, how was your meeting with the principal? And it's like, my name is Rich. And I just started from that point on saying I was Rich.
I tell you what, one way to also address that would be if someone said, Richard, you, where is he? You know?
And there's all other permutations of that, but I was named after my uncle, who was Uncle Dick. And I've actually just had some fun because my oldest daughter and I had the opportunity to have a meeting when babies started happening, grandkids started happening. And like, what was going to be your grandparent name? And I was thinking of all the things that could be, like Nona or Papa or Grandpa or all these things. And we actually arrived at Papa Dick, which is fun to say. And it's also a thing to my uncle. And it also stands out because pretty much I've never heard that before. And we have fun when we say it.
Well, it reminds me of a programmer. That's what I'll call him. He was a televangelist back in the 80s. And I don't know if he's still alive. He might be. I was working for a Christian station in the 80s and early 90s. His name was, he and his father actually did this, Peter Popoff. And then when you said that I don't know why that brought that back to mind. Hey, let's talk a little bit about you, the work you do, what you bring to the table as far as, well, I'm going to start here. You offer on your website, which again, folks, is brain-centric.com. And we encourage you to go there. You have a whole bunch. And I love that folks are doing this because it gives them the impetus to start making this shift, this transformation in their lives. You have a whole page or more of free stuff, free resources. We have the tools to keep it cognitive, and we'll talk about what that means, but talk about how you have developed these different tools that are available to the folks, and maybe more to the point, why? I often think, okay, I got the answers I need, you know, I'm going to go on a desert island and live out the rest of my life. And yet you and others and myself, we find the answers that we hope with are going to work for us for a long time. I'll find the answers I need, and I'm going to share them with other people. Whether it works for them or not, that's going to be up to them. But it works for me, and I'm going to put it out there. So talk to us a little bit about those beginnings and how we are here talking about you and the work you do.
Well, thank you for that opportunity. And in addition to our names being in common, I started out on radio. I was 19 years old. I was fresh out of high school, got an overnight DJ job, which is what I called it. At the time, it was just changing tapes on a big automation machine. But
oh yeah,
I got to record weather on carts, and I was like the real deal overnight DJ. And I got into radio. I loved it. Ended up graduating with a communications degree, which was only interrupted by several years in the military to help me pay for that communications degree. In the military, I also worked in radio for Armed Forces Radio and Television Service, and was a media specialist in the military. So I really loved love the microphone. I loved Casey Kasem growing up, you know, on a small farm out in the middle of nowhere, and didn't know what syndication was at the time. And just loved the entertainment value, the informational value, all the things that come along with live radio. And I got into radio as a DJ, went to several different markets. Then I got into promotions at radio because I was a smart alecky DJ and had all kinds of cool ideas. And then I would get frustrated that some of my cool ideas weren't sold. Therefore, they never made it to the air because they didn't have a sponsor. So I remember asking the sales manager one day, could I sell it because I want this on the air? Well, I didn't know how to sell and I didn't know what selling was, but I did know that I had a cool idea and that people could ride along with that idea if they got involved. So I ended up getting a beer distributor involved with this boat promotion that I had. And I remember about a month later going to get my paycheck, and I got two paychecks, and one was for my DJ job, which was poultry. And then I had this other commission check. I didn't know you got sales commissions. I didn't even know I was being paid for selling. I just wanted this thing on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And the commission check was better than my DJ check. And I saw the light, so to speak. And I started moving into sales and got off the air. Became pretty good at sales, became a sales manager, general manager, and then I ended up buying a couple small market stations, and which I later sold, went to work for TV, then went to work for the internet when it was first starting for Clear Channel Communications, and then finally ended up at Paul Allen from Microsoft as his director of digital in Portland back in the 90s as the internet was getting out of dial-up AOL to broadband. And that really blew the doors off of me because that was the first time I saw analytics online to where I, you know, because the radio, a lot of times you can't see the people, but on a website, I could see who was on my site, where they were at, where they were from. And it was amazing to me to see this information. And I started segueing sales into that little item there. But it wasn't until 10 years ago that I really started getting crazy with the brain-centric thing. And that's because my daughter and I, we had a horse farm, and we were both in rodeo. She was a barrel racer and I was a team roper with my son. I was the heeler. And we were going to this second day of a rodeo in Washington State, and a lady had ran a stop sign looking at her phone going about 45 miles an hour and ran over my daughter and I. We were on a bike.
Oh.
And it was a horrible event. We both survived. But I had my right arm torn off, my left leg torn off, or my right leg torn off. My daughter broke her hip and several other bones. And there was a period in the hospital where I was wondering, what's next? I can't walk. I don't have an arm. They reattached the arm. I have a prosthetic now for the right leg. But the interesting thing that happened in the hospital was, after about a month or so, they got me like into a wheelchair and out and about, and they put me in this support room where people that were all kind of buggered up like me got together and talked about their current situation. They sat me next to a large man, like super large man, the kind that fill those new chairs in hospitals where they're super wide. He was about my age. He was also missing a right leg. And I was thinking, oh my God, this is the end. This is my future. And the whole room was very sad. What was interesting though, is there was a television that was on, and it was some sort of sporting event. And as I focused in on it out of my drug stupor, it was a Paralympics. And there was a man on the TV running around the track, looking beautiful and healthy, but he had a prosthetic on his right leg. One of these, they call it a blade, this carbon fiber blade, which
I've seen those.
Yeah. You've seen those. And I was like, how can this guy be healthy running around the track with one leg be like this? And how can this guy to my left be not like that? And my thought all came down to that. It was a thought that you had the power within you to decide and choose which direction to take, regardless of your circumstances. So I decided I was going to be that guy that ran around the track, and I didn't know how to do that. And at the time, like I said, I've always been in communications. I wondered how to walk again, and how to put those thoughts together with that walking, which led me into neuroscience, like how the brain makes up decisions, which led me into cognitive neuroscience, which led me into the learning sciences of cognitive neuroscience. So that study became a study to me 10 years ago when I was in bed, because I could still read and I still had a voice. And I thought, well, if I got these two things, I've got some facilities. Over the years, this turned into me being a learning scientist, publishing a couple books on this particular journey on how the brain processes information, how people love to learn, and then the application of that process, which ends up being a series of surprises. Because when you are surprised, I can go into all the neuroscience of it, but basically when you get into a state of surprise, that is the one time your brain is 100% focused on whatever that unexpected thing is. And there's a lot of kinds of surprises. There's unexpected, there's good surprises, bad surprises, you know, there's dozens of kinds of surprises. But I thought, if I could actually serve up surprises as if I were a chef, and you know, you wanted this kind of meal and I wanted this kind of meal, but I could always deal something to where I could have you engage in whatever I was speaking of through a series of surprises, then that would be a thing. So it turned into be a bona fide pedagogic model, along with my colleague on it, Dr. Kiran Omani, that was published here about 6 years ago and has since been adopted by the Fortune 5 to the people next door. We're in 26 different languages, and we do a lot of learning and development and sales training based off of this particular model. And that's where I've ended up today. It's kind of like being a DJ, except now instead of a microphone, I've got every tool on the internet rather than a single stick, you know, pushing 5,000 watts wherever. And that's been a real joy to take what I did many, many years ago, have all kinds of wild things happen in the middle, but here I am age 61 doing the exact same thing I was doing when I was 19.
Well, obviously you and I started out at the same age of 19, although I am 64, almost 64 in June. I like to take it early, but you know, they don't let you. Anyway, yeah. And I have to tell you that that it's a fascinating journey that you have taken, rather traumatic in some areas, no question. But at the same time, here you are. And that all of the choices, and we talk about this because we talk about choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And I put this out almost every program, that all of the choices that you and I have made all the way back to our childhood. And are you sitting down for this one? All of those choices have brought us where we are today having this conversation. Now, back then, I didn't know who Rich Carr was. Didn't know there was a Rich Carr. I barely knew who I was. And yet you made the choice to live. I bring that up because my second wife, my present wife, I should say, my present wife, 25 plus years ago, we got together. We met. And then in 2001, she was diagnosed with a rare form of fallopian tube cancer. And one of the question that I asked her as she was going into the operating room, and I did ask this question, it's how I start my book, Choices. Do you want to live or do you want to die? I may not like the choice you make, but I will support you in it. Well, you, Rich, you made the choice to live, because you could have said, you know, I give up. No arm, no leg. I'm out of here. What, you know, I'll come back in another lifetime and I'll hang on to all four limbs somehow and it'll be a better life. And yet you had a better life by choosing to live. Now, it may not have been conscious necessarily. I don't know. Did that ever cross your mind early on in the process of the healing of following the trauma, the accident with your daughter?
No, you know, it was the damnedest thing when all this was going on, because I thought I did die, honestly. And it wasn't like there wasn't a light at the end of the tunnel or some of the stuff that's in TV. I remember we were lying in the ditch. Fortunately, we were hit, like I say, about 45 miles an hour. And we flew about 60 feet, and I ended up being her airbag. The reason the arm got attacked was right under my knee, but I had lifted the knee, so it had shoved my femur and everything out my backside. It was because it was a kind of a hell of an impact. And I remember laying in the ditch, and I didn't hurt, which was strange. I do remember not hurting. It was just very loud, super loud, lots of buzzing. And I looked down. I was in a position where I could look down, and things did not look right south of the border. And I was like, oh, this is not good. But out of that noise, I remember hearing, my leg, I can't straighten my leg. And that was my daughter's voice. And I thought, oh, thank goodness, it's just her leg. And then I checked out and drugged, you know, and they did all kinds of surgeries. And I came out of it later. And I remember my brother was there. And he helped me remember this because he was my power of attorney. But he said the very first thing out of my mouth was, I'll be damned, they cut it off but with the leg. And it wasn't a thing like, did I make a choice to live or die? It was like, okay, I'm alive and I'm without a leg and my daughter is alive. And how about that? You know, there wasn't a lot of deep thought into it at that point. It was just like, oh, then it was a restructuring of what the world was going to look like. Because again, I didn't know if I was going to walk. I didn't know I was going to have my right hand. I was right-handed. They have since reattached the arm. And I still knew that I had my brain, which was working. I mean, I could talk to people and understand stuff. And I could speak. And like you, I've made my living with my mouth. And I thought, okay, well, I've got that going for me. And at the time, the internet and technology was catching up, and I had not an iPad, but a Surface tablet that I could speak to, and it would, I had a platform, what was that software called? Dragon Software, that I could speak to it, and it would, you know, do my words, so I could search the internet while speaking, and I became quite good at that, and I actually adored, I've always been an avid reader, so I started down that rabbit hole of how does the brain decide to either sit in a wheelchair and get grossly overweight and ill for one guy, and take another guy and put him on a track looking svelte and wonderful as an athlete at the same age. What makes that happen? And to your book's point, it was a choice. It's like, well, you have to sit there and figure out which direction you're going to go. Mm-hmm. And you can either sit there and lament and woes all the things that you can't control, which was the past. And you can control not the future, but the actually moment you're in. Being present, I guess, is a nice way of saying that. Mm-hmm. But I was sitting there thinking, okay, well, I'm here. I've got a number of kids who are no doubt looking at me going, now what's he going to do? Because I'm all buggered up. And I'm thinking, well, I've got to set the example to my kids that, you know, this was before resiliency was a big thing, but okay, it's a setback. However, I'm here, you're here, we're here. What can we do with what we got? And when we looked at what can we do with what we got, my daughter was healing much faster than I, and she was kind of an impetus for me to be, in historical sense, the father figure. Like, oh, I better ante up my healing. I better start moving. I better start doing the things I need to do with whatever I got. And what was fun about that was the encouragement that I had from everybody around me, because I was doing things pretty much immediately that somebody who was handicapped to my extent maybe shouldn't do. And that would just be trying to walk. My dad, who is 90, he was always telling me to move. He says, don't stop moving. Once you stop moving, you're going to be all rusted and it's not going to work for you. So back to the military, I started doing small physical therapy things. And by small, I mean, like, I think on the third month of physical therapy, I finally got a coffee cup up to my lips without help. And that was a major moment just to be able to lift a coffee cup, because they reattached the arm and it was trying to get it up and moving, because you have to kind of teach it things again. And I saw progress with it. And I thought, well, I'm just going to have to be 1% per better per day. That was my goal. not to reach 100%, but I'm going to do a little more today, just 1%, not perfect, not greatness, not some arbitrary goal, but 1% better wherever I can find the 1%. That might be going to the restroom. That might be, you know, a coffee cup with my right arm. Could be a number of different things, but I just wanted to see progress. And I thought 1% was a reachable goal, and 1% on any thought was an even more reachable goal, like being nicer to a mean nurse or all those kinds of things.
So you had Nurse Ratchet, did you?
I had several of them, you know, and I was, you know, I was at Harborview Hospital, but they were great people.
Yeah.
And did great things. It was just that I wasn't quite, I was quite shocked by the amount of pain that was involved in all this. But and then on the other side of it, I was amazed at the body's inability to remember that great pain the next day. You knew it hurt, mm-hmm. but you didn't feel it.
Right.
Which was two totally different things. So I really got into brain stuff during this time because there was really nothing else for me to do than try to figure out this 3 pounds of goop in our skull.
No.
And that led to a whole new world as far as professional work is concerned and the people I work with. And it's not so much about my journey. What was really neat that came out of this was meeting Kieran, seeing that he had this pedagogic model he was pushing in academia, which is a big business. And at the time I was consulting for Nike, and I said, boy, if I could get this model into Nike, I think we would have something quite revolutionary in the world business.
Yeah.
Fortunately, Nike said, yes, we did a pilot that succeeded. We did more that succeeded. We became global. Other people saw that, became bigger global. And it's all on a thinking process. And that process isn't Tricky Dick's 10 steps to success. It's literally the, how the brain processes information, where the input comes in, how it gets past the amygdala, how it gets in your limbic system, how you focus on it, and how to make that simple so anybody can do it. And that's why the first book was written, and the second book was to further apply that.
Brain-Centric Design is his first book, and then of course we're talking about this aspect. And one of the two things I wanted to bring up: number one, you talked about, you know, going into sales, and in eighth grade, I started my working career, and this was not including, of course, prior to that, mowing lawns in the neighborhood, as well as our family's lawn. Mm-hmm. My mother, to my father's consternation, I went through, because we didn't have gasoline powered mowers. They were electric, meaning they had a cord. I went through a lot of cords. but after that, in eighth grade, I decided to become a paper boy. Now, this is going to sound bizarre. At the age of 64, well, almost, I would, if there were a job that I would ever go back to, if it even existed anymore, which it does not, I would go back to being a paperboy. I loved it. Out on the bicycle, riding around out in the wide open spaces, so to speak. I grew up in Phoenix, so not so wide open, but nonetheless, meeting all kinds of different people. And then in high school, I took on a different paper route, doing the evening paper plus the Sunday morning. And I was delivering to apartment complexes, like three or four or five of them right in a row along the main street that I lived near. Thomas was the name of the street. I could ride in, circle the pool, tossing the papers. And then, of course, we would have these subscription nights where we'd get together, we'd go to different locations, and we'd try to get people to sign up for the paper. Well, I did really well. I won trips to Disneyland all the time, okay? But I never thought of it as quote-unquote sales, and yet that's exactly what it was. And then I moved from Phoenix when I was 46 with my present wife, and the first job that I got was with a company called Bargain Network, and they sold these little pamphlets. It was sort of akin to Auto Trader. But you paid a subscription, and these booklets were supposedly updated every month, and so on and so forth. And before I left, after about 7 or 8 months of being there, I left. But before I left, I was in the special high sales room. Now, I had already told my father when I first started the job how much I hated the job, in spite of how good I was at it. To my consternation, my father said, and I don't know if your father ever said this to you, Richard, you could sell ice cubes to Eskimos. He said, that's how confident he was in my ability. And of course, as I said, I was in their high sales room for the last month before I took on the radio job that I had wanted for a long time. There's not a lot of money in it, but I will tell you, there is a lot of satisfaction, especially when it comes to helping people. And that's what you're doing. I want to ask you, this is the other part of this. Brain-centric. The human body has one of the most sophisticated, intricate, delicate, complex, and marvelous pharmaceutical companies ever devised by intelligent design, divine plan, God, whatever. As long as you put into it the ingredients that the body needs to develop those chemicals, those pharmaceuticals, we'll call them.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done or been exposed to or researched that aspect of this whole aspect of the emotional effects of surprise on the human body? I know that there's, and again, I'm going to name stuff that probably has nothing to do with this, but you know, I hear about the endorphins and this one and that one and the other, you know, and you know, we always want that high. What about that aspect, the chemical reaction in the human body, where we kind of need surprise in our lives? And again, I'm of the school, there is no good or bad surprise. You're either surprised or you're not. It's your judgment as to whether it's good or bad. If you've ever heard that old Chinese proverb about the father and his son, and the neighbor comes over every day just to check on them, see how they're doing. And one day comes over and says, oh, yeah, well, my son, he's out there and he's training this horse that he found out in the field, you know. Well, that's good. To the which the father says, who knows whether it's good or bad? Next day, how are things going? Well, my son fell off the horse and broke his leg and now he can't train the horse. Oh, that's bad. Father says, well, who's to say that's good or bad? Next day, the military comes along to conscript people. They can't conscript the son because he has a broken leg. Friend comes over, says, how are things going? Well, this is what happened. Well, that's good. And the story goes on and on and on. But I'm curious about the whole chemistry aspect and how important that is to our well-being and maybe even the healing process of the human body.
Well, I love the way you came into that because it's everything. I mean, when you come down, this is when it comes to neuroscience, the way I look at it again is through that particular lens. So I'll answer it in that lens. And the entire body works off of electricity and chemicals. So thoughts are electricity. They're going to spark something. A feeling, and that feeling, there's a ton of feelings that I can go over. Pilchuk's emotion wheel, or what we call the emotional mood ring, and how those things do what they do. But basically, a thought or feeling will launch a chemical reaction within your body, and that chemical reaction will dictate your behavior a lot of ways. So for example, if all of a sudden something scary happens, like you get one of those texts from your children that you don't know if it's a good text or a bad text, it just mm-hmm. says, call me. That's that feeling you get in your stomach. That's a chemical. That's mm-hmm. cortisol. Cortisol, it makes you worry. You always hear things about dopamine, you know, the reward neurotransmitter. These chemicals are neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. Most of these chemicals are made in your stomach. And they travel up your vagus nerve into your brain, and your brain reacts accordingly based off of this chemical that you can basically regulate with your thoughts. And there are several neurotransmitters, and if this was a video recording, you can see over one of my shoulders, there's a serotonin module up on my wall, which is the kind of chemical that makes you feel like you're part of the herd, that I belong to this group when you're in church and the pasture says, you know, hey, say hello to your neighbor. You know, there's a little bit of that going on. When you feel like you're part of the herd in a psychologically safe workspace, you feel like you belong. Well, that feeling is a chemical, and how your brain reacts to the chemical. So I literally look at everything that way, and that the body is, we could call it a temple, we could give it all kinds of words, but it is this thing that is meant to heal itself. And if you put the right things in, whether that's thoughts or food or nutrition, typically the right things come out. When people get sick, what's the very first thing they do? They usually alter their diet, because their diet is the thing that is either feeding them or poisoning them or doing both of those things. And really, all the things we learned as children, by the way, I started out on a paper route as well, all had to do with eat right and exercise and get sleep. Well, that's precisely what your body needs. Eat right is the nutrients that make sure this whole organism gets the things that it needs to continue to do what it does. Exercise makes sure that there's no lethargy in anything. And that counts with your brain, your arms, your legs, your midriff, whatever you're talking about as far as exercise. You've got to keep this machine moving all the time. And sleep is where all of this stuff congeals and works out to your benefit. If you get the right amount of sleep, your brain, through cerebral fluid, washes out old memories, bad things you're not thinking about, and congeals the new stuff you learned that day. Exercise, your body repairs itself at night, you know, so the torn or stretched muscles you did while working out are now also getting the fluid rolling through them to make them work. Sleep gives everything an opportunity to basically rejuvenate and congeal and wake up and do it all over again. So if you have the opportunity to eat right and exercise and get enough sleep, more often than not, you'll see a healthier person than one who does not exercise, eats incorrectly, and has bad sleep. I mean, it's an organism, and it all runs off of electricity and chemicals. So to your point, I think that's the essence of this body, is that you need to realize that it is an organism, that you do have the choice to either treat it as it should be, or augment what you need to, or pull back on what you need to, and get yourself in a position to where you feel good inside your own skin. The thing that messes that up is everybody else's opinion and marketing. Because this is all I used to do, is sell radio. And when you look at it, you sell a lot of stuff people don't need. You're doing it for yourself, for me here now. It's all about me here now. In fact, that's what the brain's about, is really this magnificent organism really has two functions: to keep you alive. That's the 80% of your reactive brain. Sometimes people call it the animal brain or the reptile brain or so on and so forth. But that's the part of your brain that regulates body temperature, breathing, all the things that you kind of do automatically to keep you alive. It also protects you, meaning that you and I react, 80% of our day we're reacting based off of some kind of outside stimuli. 20% of the time we're actually in control of our own thoughts. Now, if you can increase that 20% of the time, you're going to be a much happier person. And you can only, when we talk to emotions, to their very first question, you can only assimilate new information that will be internalized and reacted upon after the fact if you're in the one emotion of happy or joy. You cannot learn algebra by being chased by a lion, much like you cannot learn a new job position if somebody is screaming down your face. You can't internalize that information. But if you're thinking about the situation, you're going, hey, this is about me right here, right now, you're in a happy space and you can internalize that information. It's the difference between, say, a hobby. Like when you're into a hobby, you're all in, and you can go and meet with a group of people that are in this hobby and you can talk about anything because it's a safe spot. You're talking about the hobby. But if you go into a business office and suddenly the sales manager is bitching at you because you didn't hit quota, and you know, you spend too much time looking at your t-shirt or whatever it is they're yelling at you at, none of that stuff's going to be internalized. All of that input results in a chemical reaction based off of the feeling of what's coming in. And there are 8 primary emotions. Only one of them you can learn in, and only one of them can get you out of a bad emotion into a good emotion. And that emotion is surprise.
Well, it's interesting because that you put it in this context, because in the last, 24, 48, I would say last 48 hours, I've had multiple surprises going different directions, opposite directions. And I'll share briefly. Sunday morning, we get up and we had decided we're going to go to the lake, which is literally 15, 20 minute drive from our home, Lake Kachuma here in Santa Barbara County. And they have a restaurant there, and we're going to have breakfast by the lakeside. Little fog, little marine layer, or if you will, on the surface of the water, but it's still clear skies, sunny, beautiful, nice and cool, no bugs. Have our breakfast, a little coffee, a little tea, you know, just, it's a wonderful morning. I'm just thinking, this is great, you know? I mean, everything isn't perfect as far as the rest of our lives, but this moment, this here, this now, wonderful. We go home, and then we hear a knocking on the door. I'm thinking, you know, out in the yard, there was a woodpecker that's been pecking away at something the last few days, and I'm thinking that's what it is. No, it's somebody knocking it. I go to the door, and it turns out, because we've been having a few struggles, that we've been given notice that unless we do something quickly, we're going to have to vacate. And I'm thinking, what are we going to do? I'm not really thinking of any answers right that moment. I'm just thinking, okay, on top of everything else that's happened over the last couple, 3 years, now this. Well, then when I kind of came back to my intellect, I began to formulate a plan. I carried it out. And we are not going to have to vacate. And then where we received the assistance, and it was from my family, and I am such a believer in and an advocate for people setting up networks, either within their families and where they live. We've been here for 18 years in Santa Barbara, and we have what I would consider to be an extensive network of friends. And they don't want to see us in distress and hurt and this and that. So many of them stepped up to support us. And then this morning I get a call from my elder sister, and I couldn't answer it, but she left a voicemail basically saying, call me because I have some better news for you. And I called her, and it turns out that the support that we were given by the family, don't worry about it. We supported you not to add stress to your life. Just relax, take care of what you need to take care of, and we'll deal down the road. It could be next year with, you know, all this other stuff. So one surprise after another, you know, first it's, shock, surprise. Then it's sort of relief, surprise, but still in the back of my mind going, oh man, this thing's hanging over our head. No, it's not hanging over your head anymore. Even greater relief, surprise for both my wife and I.
Yeah.
And then I walk into the studio and I turn on Zoom and I let Richard Carr into the Zoom room to have a conversation about BrainCentric and the emotion of surprise, and thinking, wow, boy, the universe is sure synchronizing my life. This is wonderful. We're talking about BrainCentric design as well. BrainCentric.com, Brain-Centric.com is his website, and we're going to have that link up as well. You mentioned the pictures behind you and this and that and the other. Well, folks are going to see that because we are also on YouTube, where people can watch these conversations. So that's very cool. I'm curious, and I don't want to forget about this. Yeah, there you go. There you go. I see it. Folks who are listening on the broadcast or the podcast, you're going to have to go to YouTube to see what he was pointing at. I want to go back, and I want to ask how was and is your daughter today?
She is awesome, and thank you for asking. She was 13 when this happened, and she went on to, I told you she was a barrel racer. Well, she ended up after she recuperated. She had a broken femoral head, hip, and a shattered lower leg shin thing, a bunch of other little things. But she not only recouped, but she ended up getting a scholarship to Texas A&M University in barrel racing, which I didn't even know was a thing. She had broken every conceivable record in 4-H and WASET, these different groups for horse enthusiasts up here in the Northwest, and got the attention of a couple different schools, and she picked A&M. I'm from Texas originally, and I've always spoken highly of Texas. She loved it. In fact, she ended up staying there. She has since graduated. She now works in finance for Gartner Communications, which is a research and analyst firm globally, and she's kicking butt. I couldn't be more proud of her. We have a really unique relationship because of all this, because I've got four kids overall. She's my youngest, and she is an amazing person, and she has a different outlook on life too, because we both almost died, if you look at it that way. But at the same time, experiencing that, neither one of us are in the least bit afraid of it. It's really hard on the person's left over, but when you get clocked by a car like that, it's just over with. It's just over with. I have Polaroid type of snapshots of things that were happening during the healing process, as does she, and we'll talk about that. And she just looks at it as she's a tough cookie. She's resilient. She can overcome anything, and that's her attitude going through life. And she's again crushing it, because she has had a long moment of heavy disequilibrium, where everything was taken from her. Because during this whole episode, there was a divorce where I got custody, because there was all kinds of things wrong. There was some embezzlement thing. There was all kinds of weirdness that happened. But at the end of the day, she has emerged victorious and one of the strongest people I've ever known.
Hmm. Well, and I will say, in spite of what you had to go through relationally, that says an awful lot about the combination of you and your ex-wife in terms of bringing her into the world. And now she's going to make an amazing difference in the lives of others. And that's one of the things I think about. And I love the fact that you mentioned your father. He's 90 now.
He's 90 now. Yeah. 90 and a half. He'll be 91 in December.
He was 91 when he passed last March. And I talk about him on occasion. And I always love it when my guests bring up their fathers, because for me, my father was obviously a very significant part in my life. In spite of the fact that he didn't think he was, he worked 9 to 5. He worked at a print shop, and he came home. As he didn't drive, so my mother would go take him to work in the morning, and she'd pick him up in the evening, and he was home the rest of the evening. So it's like, I don't get it. How do you? But that was his perspective. But he showed me what it was, not only in terms of how to treat people, how to treat his family. And when I was at the memorial and I was listening to my brother and sisters share their perspectives, it wasn't that I didn't see this in him. It just wasn't something that stuck out to me. But they talked about his honesty. He was one of the most honest men they had ever known. Well, I certainly would echo that, but it wasn't like I saw him when he was dishonest and now he's honest to a fault. It wasn't that. It was just, this was my dad. And this is the way he was. I'm curious as to how much of who you are, you have gleaned, not necessarily genetically, but just as a course of living with him and being raised by him. I'm curious as to some of the things you can pinpoint and say, yeah, my father said this and taught me that and so forth. And I'll share you real quick that my father used to say that eat, drink, and be merry in moderation, because no one gets out of this world alive. And basically he was saying, enjoy your life.
Yeah, I would I think, you know, nothing against your dad, but I think I have the greatest dad that ever existed.
And I'm not going to take that away from you. No.
You know, and a good deal of my life, he was always overseas in some war or something. You know, he did a couple of them. He did in Vietnam. He was over in, I won't go into all the things, but he's seen a lot. And the great thing about my dad to this day is he has his own lexicon for everything. So like growing up, I actually didn't know chicken eggs were chicken eggs until later, because we always called them cackleberries.
I love that.
Because that was the sound, you know, when there was a cackle, there was a berry, and we had to go pick them in the morning, pick cackleberries. But the little weird things, but he would always say things like, trust your gut. Everything after that is you trying to talk yourself out of your life experience. He would say stuff like, when I was all buggered up, like I said, he was one, he says, hey, no matter what, you got to keep moving. I've been through wartime. The people that moved survived. The people that retired and took it easy died. You know, you have to, he has all these little, just, it's almost like a lost art of taking life lessons and turning them into a certain little statement that is really made me fall in love with the brain, because my dad, without knowing it, or maybe he did know it, does know it, he facilitates a thinking system all the time. I very rarely get an opinion from my dad. He says, you're your own person, you'll make your own decisions. But I will get these little things that make me think, like, if you have to ask if it's wrong or right, it's wrong. That's your body saying there's a question, you know, so go right. don't even argue with yourself. You know, memories, or even like my situation that we spoke of. I've got this picture of a bookshelf in my life. That's just a bookshelf. Nobody can see. But everything that happened to me is on the bookshelf. I have the opportunity to go pick up that book and dwell on it and go, woe's me. Or I can look at it, go, yep, read that one, but I'm over here on these new books. And you know, it was just a nice way of maybe compartmentalizing everything and making everything come down to a thought that whatever is good for you, make sure it doesn't hurt somebody else. And obviously I did that as a kid. You know, I was a 6 foot and 180 pounds when I was, you know, a freshman in high school. And I threw that weight around, you know, when you're a kid and you don't know stuff. But even when I got in trouble, you know, he had these little things he would tell me. And instead of saying, you do this or you do this, they made me think. And again, that carried on into my career today, because what BrainCentric Design is and what Surprised is, are documents on how to facilitate thinking in others and yourself, but mostly others. When you learn it, you see how to handle your own things, and you know how to position certain points of influence and how the brain will process a piece of information. I can get into all the geeky stuff, but at the end of the day, it all comes down to, could I be like half the man my dad is? I still have 30 years to catch up with his current age, but he was shelling that stuff out when I was just a kid. And he's a big, tough guy too, but he always had these really wonderful things that, instead of telling me what to do, which in science would be behaviorism, like how we went to school, sit down, shut up, listen, take a test. Instead of doing that, he would say something that would make me think. And I've always fell in love with that, because here's something profound. I think it's profound anyway, is that you and me, anybody listening right now, you've never been taught to think. You've only been told to think. And the difference now is that you can teach yourself to think, and that's called a pedagogic model. And that pedagogic model is BrainCentric Design. That is a bona fide, here's how your brain works thing. Here's how your brain thinks. And that's, I think, is just a wonderful gift of anybody, to be untethered to somebody else and to be able to critically think about anything in a way that the brain will process that information and you can decide accordingly.
I know that there are other terms as well for the, you know, learning that process. Critical thinking is one. I've often, well, I shouldn't say often because I don't know for sure, but some of my positions, my perspectives, my observations, as I like to call them, they're not opinions, they're observations. I see things and I say, you know, that doesn't make any sense. When I was working for the Christian radio station for all of 15 years, I might add, I was asking what would be considered quite heretical questions. You don't ask those questions. You just read what they said and you follow. But it didn't make any sense. And that's kind of where I come from, whether it's, you know, whether it's religion or politics or education, et cetera, et cetera. And some might say, you know, it's progressive thinking. Some of my positions might be construed as, you know, left or right or center or whatever. I don't. It's just my observations, and I don't put them on anybody else. They're mine. All right. And I learned that early on, probably when I was 21, 22, and I was talking with my general manager, the first station I ever worked for. And and she said, when after I shared with her the problem I was having, she said, well, you know, you might think of it this way. The more you think about it, the more you dwell on it, the more power you give it. And then, of course, there's the other part of it, too, that I learned later on is, and the more you dwell on it, the more you're living in the past. You're not here now. So yeah. I stopped dwelling on it, and it was never a problem again.
Yeah, dwelling is a waste of time.
Yep.
And you're certainly not present, you know, and again, I'll think of something my dad just would say all the time. If I'd ask him on his opinion on something or advice on something to get it, he would often say, or I would ask him about how he did it and all this other stuff or what his things were on it. And he'd come back with something like, you know, Rich, some of my best memories are mine.
I think that's great. That is, there was a gentleman, you may or may not know him. His name is Noah Benchia. And back many years ago, a couple, three decades, he used to have some of his wise sayings, if you will, printed on the Starbucks coffee cups. Hmm. And I'm thinking that's where that belongs, on one of those. Or I think Dixie Cup used to do that. They used to put phrases, yeah, or something on them.
Or in the bottle cap of soda when we were kids, they had a little thing on the bottom of those.
And I'm not sure if Snapple still does that, but I just find that fascinating. I really do. It's just very cool.
Yeah, no, that was always one of those things people say, you know, what do you think about that? And I'll sometimes have it queued up because it's an answer you can't refute. Hey, yeah. You know what, Richard? You know, some of my best memories are mine.
I love that. Rich Carr is our guest here on the program. By the way, I always find it fascinating as I'm doing these programs how I shift from singular to plural. because yeah, I'm here and we're doing our thing and I'm having a good time, but honestly, it's not all about me. In spite of what you said at the early part of the program, that it is all about me, unless it's you talking and then it's all about you. The fact of the matter is that we're all here together. And I think that's one of the other aspects of this whole aspect of brain-centric design, that we want to talk a little bit about before we wrap things up, because I know we're coming close to the clock ending here because we both have to move on to other things. But I love our conversation and what we're trying to accomplish here is to share with people these ideas, these concepts that will help them to, and I like to put it this way, transform their lives. One of my guests said, you gotta get rid of the word change, because if it can be changed one way, it can be changed back the other. And I thought, well, okay, I get that. But if you can transform something, can't you transform it back the other way? I mean, take a look at the Transformers.
Good point.
You know, but I'm gonna take it at face value for what he offered and just say that that's what we want to do. And I find that, Jesus, when he told the disciples that they're going to do greater works than him, I believe that's the greater work, and that is the changing or transforming of our lives. That's really, truly the greater work. Do you believe, feel, know, observe that the work that that you are doing is it's sort of like the underlying, you want help to help people to do just that and to raise their consciousness. Is this a process that can help to do that?
Primarily because it simplifies it. It shows you, much to your point, that we live in a state of transformation. And for those who say there's change management and things of that nature, it's like, well, it's a good term, but nothing remains the same ever. Nothing. And you might think it does, but look at it, you know, tomorrow and it's different. And your thoughts are the same way too. You might not like olives today, and then tomorrow you have a tapenade or a muffuletta, and all of a sudden it's like, what is that taste? And it's olives.
Yeah.
You know, so those things are fluid, transforming. And if you have that mindset going into everything, then everything becomes a surprise and everything's a gift, because it's like, oh, what am I going to do with this? I've got more than I did yesterday, and I've got the wisdom of knowing this thing I don't like, and here's this new opportunity that I might go play with. You know, we're just learning again, fellowship and how to talk to people again. And I think as the pendulum swings on society, we'll see that we are all in the same herd, that we all do change, and that collaboration really makes things merrier, because I have my thoughts and all of a sudden Mr. Dugan says this, and it's like, oh, I like that. I'm going to adapt that as one of my thoughts. And that's why I like the show or books or going down to the lake and talking to people are all joyous things to us, because in this whole transformation thing of life where we change every day, we have the opportunity to pick and choose the things we want to transform into. And if you cannot dwell on the things that were bad decisions, because we all have them, but you know what? That have is a past tense thing. It's nothing that's in front of you. And I can, if I wasn't walking today, well, damn it, I'm going to walk tomorrow. And that's an attitude I think can help a lot of people. The book itself sets into that, because it's the process in which those things are integrated into your person. So to answer your question, yes, I do feel it transforms everybody.
The Emotion of Surprise is his latest work. Brain-Centric Design is his first work. And Brain-Centric Design is the web. I should rephrase that. Braincentric.com is the website. We encourage you to go there and find out more. I have three quick questions I'm going to ask you before we wrap things up, because we both have to head on out. And the first of those three questions is, who is Rich Carr?
Rich Carr is a question I've never been asked before. Just a fluid body trying to do good.
What is it that gets you up in the morning?
The excitement of what I do.
And finally, what was your best day?
Today.
Rich, I thank you so much, and I hope we can have you back again to continue our conversation. I find this fascinating, and maybe we can get a little bit more into, I don't know, the science of it, the more practical aspects of it.
I'd love to do that, Richard, and I really appreciate being on your show. Thank you so much.
And we'll also talk about your podcast on a future program as well. I thank you for listening to and watching Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, where we're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And until our next broadcast, podcast, videocast, love to Lal. Jeanette, I am still listening. Dad, continue to be happy, because I am. To my dear friend Smokey, I'll see you on the other side. And to my dear friend Zorro, aho, aho.